Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you.
New York to Bishop's Rock off the English coast in 3 days, 10 hours, and 40 minutes, the liner United States established a new Atlantic speed record, July 6, 1952. Cheering crowds at Southampton hailed the American ship that had clipped 10 hours from the transatlantic mark set by Britain's own Queen Mary. Then westbound, the United States knifing through the Atlantic for her second record crossing. It was noted by the builders of the ship that in the event of necessity for emergency conversion to military service, the United States could transport 14,000 men, or virtually a full division, 10,000 miles without putting into port for food, fresh water, or fuel. But for the crew and officials and passengers aboard the liner, the greatest moment was now at hand. The United States was reaching Ambrose Lightship outside New York with the Blue Riband of the Atlantic, having made the return trip in a record 3 days, 12 hours, 12 minutes. Saluting the ship whose maiden voyage shattered Atlantic speed marks going over and coming back. At the turn of the century and beyond, Great Britain and Germany dominated leadership in fast Atlantic crossings. Now, for the first time in almost 100 years, the speed crown was claimed by the Stars and Stripes. New York, home port for many of the greatest ships on the oceans, really put on a show. A big broom symbolized the sweep of the Blue Ribbon Speed Trophy by the $70 million United States, America's first lady of the high seas.
Reverend Murray, are you there?
I'm here.
I am so sorry. I think I've been talking to a muted phone. The show started and I did the introduction, but I'm sitting here and I said, Reverend Murray, are you there? And you didn't answer. And then I looked at the phone and it's been muted. Oh, forgive me, folks.
I have the
distinct pleasure of introducing Reverend Cecil Murray, who is an Air Force veteran of the Korean War, retired pastor of First AME, who is joining us this afternoon to share a few minutes with us and give us his perspective as veterans and different things like that and share with us whatever he chooses to share. So, Reverend, how are you?
Just fine. Thank you, George, and I pray God's blessings upon you and all who are listening. There's no greater gift than health.
Absolutely, absolutely. I recently was out today with veterans. I'm sitting here. I have a supporter of veterans in the background. But I have a supporter of veterans in the background here who's with us. She is a supporter, but not a veteran, but someone who has supported our causes. And she's been with me for a minute on the journey as a veteran, as an observer. And I find it completely fascinating because this is a civilian. And we're taught that our veterans mean so much to our nation. But yet, I just find it perplexing that our government, when we have a shutdown, leaves our fallen on the tarmac. That's what started this radio station. But moreover, that we're still having veterans that when you walk in cities like New York or Los Angeles or Denver or any one of 37 states throughout the country, our veterans are having, some of them are having a really hard time, Pastor. Not all are, but some, a lot are of our homeless.
And a good example of that would be the homeless situation. In America, we have some 3 million homeless. Here in our city, we have some 40,000, and in the county, some 80,000 homeless persons. And now in the last 4 or 5 years, a large portion of those homeless have been veterans. And you saw how the president, with an executive order recently, began to bring aid in the millions to homeless veterans, because it is totally unfair for our nation, which has been saved by those who risk themselves, even fully giving themselves, and when they are released to come back, there is no support base. There has to be housing. There has to be treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. There has to be job training. There has to be job openings and possibilities for those who are jobless. But we almost say to them, welcome home, goodbye. And now there are programs, and I pray that they are working so that our homeless veterans will find a home.
Exactly. You know, there is an initiative by the current president to end veteran homelessness by 2016. But when we are within certain areas, we're still finding that there are a lot of veterans that are still on the street because they're being overlooked.
Yes.
Because of policy. And the thing is that living in a lot of economic areas, many veterans are burdened with, if you do have an income, if you're 100% disabled, you are situated such that your income or your compensation, your monthly compensation, is absorbed by the housing cost of living in a major metropolitan city in 37 states within this nation.
Goodness.
That 37 states include cities like New York, L.A., Washington, D.C., Miami, Houston. You think of any major metropolitan city, and I assure you that some of the homeless that you find there will be veterans.
Precisely.
You know, Pastor, I want to ask you, you think it's fair to rob a man of his wages? As far as if we volunteer to serve this nation, do you think it's fair that we should pay for an hourly wage for the troops that serve, at least minimum wage, for their, even for their time on call?
If we can begin to look fairly at a minimum wage for all Americans, then most definitely we need to look at a minimum wage for veteran Americans, those who have served in the military, have been at risk and in some degree at a loss. So we should find some minimum level so that the elevator will not go below that limit, and we will rise and we will rise. Right now there's a great struggle on to make the minimum wage at least $15 an hour for our nation and to put it in action in all states. I think it would really help, because those who are in the upper wages, well-to-do, even middle-income or middle class and so forth, it isn't as strict a need as it is on the bottom level, where some places have $8 an hour, $9, $10 an hour, and here in the 21st century, it's extraordinarily difficult to live at a below minimum wage level. So we have an obligation generally to raise the level for minimum wage. And we have an obligation specifically to see that our veterans have that minimum wage.
Exactly, because, you know, my whole thing on this, Pastor, is that we rob people of the ability to have a life when we pay them below the minimum wage. These are men and women that are expected to be anywhere in the world in less than 24 hours. Oftentimes, they're required by law to be there in less than 18. So if we're not paying them for their labor a decent wage, and I'm not talking about the other benefits. I'm not talking about the housing. I'm not talking about the food. That's all well and good. But when we look at the fact that when the Militia Act was first written, that it stated that it was for every able-bodied white male between 18 and 45.
Yes.
Oftentimes, the provisions that were given were housing and subsistence for food. This is historic. But we have lagged economically, at least as far as I can trace, since the Bonus Army, economically behind our civilian counterparts. And the most recent theater of war, Iraq and Iran, we had people that were earning six figures to wash laundry. So if we have people earning six figures of washing laundry, what is $35,000 compared to that six-figure salary that that veteran is earning? What are we saying to the men and women of this nation that has answered the call of liberty to be able to survive? Because I know at the bases we have officers at Camp Pendleton that food stamp services are available. And oftentimes they'll say, well, you have to be responsible and not have so many kids. But if children are a gift from God, then we need to equip the military to be able to deal with the responsibilities of rearing a family, which includes taking care of or being able to take care of the financial needs for those that God has chosen to place within your life. You know, I get to these people that are pro-life, and when I start pointing out these things, they're like, oh, no, you have a set salary. But the thing is that if you're going to be honest about it, we have to pay people a fair wage in order for them to be able to have a living standard to be able to survive in an emergency. And I don't think that that's so unreasonable.
No.
I mean, it seems logical if a person has to jump rope, trot around the world to defend this nation. I don't think that we're asking for too much.
No, we're not. And we call ourselves the home of the free and the homeland of the free and the home of the brave. And we have people who are free because of those who are brave, because of those who have taken risks that all might be free. We find it not only now among the veterans presently, but when we look at veterans on an ethnic or a racial basis, the first to die in the American War, the Revolutionary War, black, Crispus Attucks, a black man, the first to die in the Civil War, Nicholas Biddle, a black man. When you get to the Spanish-American War that gave our nation Guam, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and ultimately Hawaii, it was the black troops who at that time were called the Buffalo Soldiers by the Native Americans out of admiration for their skills and all, at the Battle of San Juan. And Theodore Roosevelt, who was something of an avowed racist, went on to say that we could not possibly have won that battle, that war, what you haven't seen in
it. One of my personal heroes that helped change Theodore Roosevelt's mind was Dennis Bell, a black man who helped to capture San Juan Hill with Theodore Roosevelt.
Beautiful.
One of the first black men to be honored with the Congressional Medal of Honor.
And Theodore Roosevelt himself said that you haven't seen anything until you've seen the black man steal. They went charging up San Juan Hill, figured a song that my generation knows well. I don't know if you young folk know it. I said, come along, little children, come along, while the moon is shining bright. Get on board, little children, get on board. We're going to raise a ruckus tonight. They did that, and they took over, and they won that battle, and we won that war. Then, when you get to such as World Wars I and World War II, we remember one of the first heroes of World War II with Pearl Harbor was Dory Miller. At that time, blacks were restricted to menial tasks, seas in the Navy, assigned to kitchen duties. But on deck, the machine gunner was shot down. He leaves the kitchen, takes off his apron, takes that machine gun, and shoots down five Japanese Zeros. And he becomes a hero, Dory Miller. And that recruited thousands of blacks into the battle. And with the Korean War, the first group to win a major victory was the 54th Infantry Battalion, which was black. The Civil War, there you were. Abraham Lincoln said that without the black soldier, the North could not have won the war against the South. In one battle alone, 10 blacks won the Congressional Medal of Honor. So we have quite a history in Vietnam and in the Iraq era. The 40% of the troops in uniform were black, and we have much to say about this very moment, the military integrated in 1948. I went into flying training in 1951, and the major of our battalion, a white Texan, sent for me. Now, Murray, because I was only black in the squadron, I'm going to tell you, I don't like the color, but I'm going to try to treat you right. I saluted. But, oh, my Lord, if he could have read the nerves in my stomach, they would say to him, I'm going to show you something. But we went on. The Tuskegee Airmen celebrated today, were really there. But that got started. Ms. Mary McLeod Bethune, founder of Bethune-Cookman College in Daytona Beach, Florida, was a very good friend to Eleanor Roosevelt, the president's wife, and Miss Bethune convinced Mrs. Roosevelt that we need to allow black men to fly. At Tuskegee, we need to set up a school for flying. So Eleanor Roosevelt took it to her husband, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and they ultimately started the school for black men in Tuskegee. It became the Tuskegee Airmen, the 99th Pursuit Squadron, and we know the victories they won, the escort duty they were assigned to in Italy, but they never lost a plane they were escorting. They were truly heroes of that time. So when you look at veterans and veterans' rights, how do you let a person risk their lives for you? Then when the battle and the war are ended, they come home to sit at the back of the bus. They come home to have a separate restroom. They come home to be denied white-collar jobs. they come home, even with the black or blue-collar jobs, they hardly can make a minimum wage. So there are things that we need to consider in the well-being of our country, the land of the free and the home of the brave. Yes.
What I have difficulty with sometimes these days, Pastor, in talking to our men and women who serve, who tell us, I get by just fine off of what I have. They make it sound as though they feel as though, and I'm not trying to attack their self-worth because I believe that their service is worth so much more, because I think that if they think that they're living well off of minimum wage or less than minimum wage, I disagree with that because I think they should be compensated more. If you are on call to a job 168 hours a week, that's all the hours in a week. That's every hour in a week. And if you're subject to be called up to that job, I think that the least we can do is pay you something that supports a family that is subject to loss at any time, for lack of a better word. Because
yes,
there's a day that may come in the life of this nation that you could walk out of the door of the of your threshold, of your home, and not come back.
Yes.
It's luck of the draw when you take that oath. Moreover, when our men and women take an oath to the Constitution, were you aware that they renounced their citizenship for a time? That's how serious this is. We don't often talk about that, but after learning and reading it in the law, which I'm going to bring out in a day or two on the air, to actually share that with the audience about where it is if you take an oath in the United States, whether it's for mayor, Congress, but you are placed under the jurisdiction of the United, under the UN. And the thing is that we're not aware of that, but this is something that I think if we're going to take an oath to serve a nation, that that nation should respect the value of that person's labor so that they have a living wage. There should be no need for a veteran to be homeless, ever. There should be no need for a veteran for want of food. There should be no need for a veteran, because you have a family, to be considered irresponsible because you can't take care of your family. We owe that veteran that, at least that much. Because I think that the document that we took an oath to protect and defend says that it guarantees the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. If we look at it in the egalitarian form, in its realistic form, we're finding that we have legislators that are still finding fit to pay the men and women of the military in the proposed 2016 budget $2.35 per hour for a 168-hour week, based on 1561, which is the current budget for an E-1 entering into the military. Now, if we consider the least of these as worthy of military service that take the vow to take the cut, and we get into the Soldier, Sailors, and Relief Act, and we look at everything like that, we look at the various militia acts, and all militia acts in the state of in the United States always guarantee the veteran the ability for housing and food. So at this point, I don't mean to go on and on, but I'm just saying if those are included in the Militia Act and are a part of the honor debt, why are we having a problem today?
I think our problem today is exacerbated by the fact that we have good intentions at times, but we don't act on our intentions. We keep distance. Statistics show that some 67% of Americans would be for a minimum wage, and I wouldn't be surprised if it was even a little higher than those stats. But then if we have the majority of the people who are for it, then why don't we act on what we feel rather than just feeling it and checking off a box with the pen and letting someone taking statistics say that, yes, our hearts are right, but we do nothing. We have the choice between being careful, carefree, or careless. And when we disengage, that means we are carefree, or we could care less. Or when we say, I got mine, let them get theirs. Again, carefree, careless. Oh, happy day, I got everything going my way. And we look out, and there we are with 30 million Americans going to bed hungry every night, nutritionally deprived, we call it. In the richest, most powerful nation in the history of the world, 30 million people going hungry, 3 million homeless. In the underserved communities, the poverty rate double that of the national rate of poverty. Then when we look in the underserved communities, the employment rate, unemployment, triple that of the national average. So sooner or later, the careless and the carefree are going to become, have to become, the careful, because in the 21st century, people are no longer going to tolerate inequity, a lack of freedom and justice for all.
You know, I agree with you. And, you know, the thing that I have been trying to bring to the American public is that we owe the veterans so much more. Because historically, at least since the Bonus Army, the National Economy Act, where the Bonus Army didn't get the promises that they were promised of the $3,000, which they were willing to even settle for $1,000 in hard times. But this leads me to the question of what does that have to do with today? Well, on this radio station, we put out ads. We took up the Republican side that said, yeah, Ted Cruz said, sell Girl Scout cookies, we sell socks. So we challenged him to buy some socks. To this day, we're still waiting. We have gone to Donald Trump. He tells veterans all of what he promises to do for them, and we say, well, sir, you've been in business for 30 years. Show us the roster of veterans that you've helped already to kind of give us some inkling of what you're going to do if you get into the CEO position of the United States. It is a corporation. That's what the United States is. So if you're going to take that spot, if you have a record in business that you've helped the number of veterans, how many veterans are there that you've helped? I mean, this is a simple question. We've known each other for many years, a couple of decades at least, Pastor.
Yes.
You know that my roots are from the East Coast. I grew up in New Jersey. I watched the World Trade Center being built from the city of Newark, where I grew up. So I'm a New Yorker for most parts. I'm influenced by what happens in New York. I've watched Donald Trump personally. I've been, as long as you've known me, Pastor, I mean, you can tell people that I've been somewhat conscious politically. That being said, I watch what happens. Now we have a candidate that's running for president, and I say to him as a member of the press, where is your list of veterans that you've helped? I'm not asking, you don't have to identify names, but give me some sort of statistic or figure since you've been in business for over 30 years of what you've done. He asked us for an endorsement. We can't endorse as a 501c3 or a 501c19, but the end result of it is that as a member of the press, these are important and germane questions to what are you going to do for veterans if you become president? I mean, I don't think that this is rocket science. I think that if you can show us a little bit of history of what you've done, we'd have something to look forward to. But when you come with a promise that you're going to do something, you're going to make something better, and different things like that, historically, I seem to remember that that's what came to the bonus army.
Yes.
You know, promises.
And our privileged, that 1% that controls the other 99% in America, or closer to home, the haves who control the have-nots, they need to really dig a little deeper. Donald Trump, I hear what you're saying about immigrants and immigration, but aren't you pushing a little hard with the sword instead of pulling forward with the hand? People are people. Can't we find some constructive means to safeguard the border? We must have borders, yes, we must have borders. But when immigrants now up into the millions here in the country, we are going to have to be utterly creative, because we were part of the problem that we waited till it almost got out of bounds. And now with women and children, you can't be that brutal. And yes, if we build a wall, he's going to demand that Mexico pays for it. Now, how ridiculous can you be? You think that you're going to build a wall to keep them out and then make them pay for it? This is the kind of thinking that the conservative element in our nation is going to have to sort of check themselves with, because anybody who's closer to the left or closer to liberal or closer to center will look at that on the far right and say, are you crazy? You are living in the 18th century, the 19th century. This is time for you to use your mind. We have to be creative. If veterans suffer everything, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, some years, 20 years, some don't endure, survive at all. Others come back with amputation. Others come back with post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's a malady in America and so forth. And aren't you going to be in that list of those who are careful? Or are you just going to generalize, throw them away because you are rich, or because you are richer, or because you are well-to-do? It makes no sense at all.
Well, you know, that brings me back to the fact of the matter. I look at the vessel of the SS United States, the world's fastest ocean liner ever built in this country. It was built as a true transport passenger. And one of the reasons why I hold that vessel up so high is because that in a time of segregation in this country, at least if you boarded that vessel, you found some respite from segregation, because the United States on the international market did not play segregation. So those that could afford first class rode first class. Often they were people like Ella Fitzgerald, Duke Ellington, and others.
Yes.
But the fact of the matter was that this one vessel, for a moment, when in the South you'd have to stay at segregated hotels, you were allowed to fly on, to travel on an international vessel of great speed to make a difference, to get to your destination as an American without prejudice.
Right.
And you were treated as an equal. So now, after this great ship has won blue ribbons, stripped the Queen Mary, as we heard in the introduction, here is a veteran. It was a troop transport. So essentially, in the life of this machine, it was built for to help the war effort. So it's a veteran. So in the process of all of that, winning all of that, now we get to some 1952 to today. We're dealing with some 60 years later, and here the vessel's ready to be sold for scrap. But the vessel never achieved its full speed at sea during its commercial life because of the fact that it settled down to just over the Queens, but not enough to open up a new can to break another new record. So if we brought this piece of machinery back to life today, which it's in good shape to do, if we brought it back today, it could win another new record. Well, my whole thing is if we do this to a vessel that bears the name of the ship of state of the United States, what hope do we have as vessels, as veterans, but as a symbol of what happens to veterans, look at this veteran. It's highly decorated, even though it's a vessel, you know, to win a blue ribbon and be a promoter of peace and different things like that. We are facing the same fate because a lot of times they would rather leave us to die. They're veterans that die waiting, fighting for their disability and never get answered hundreds of years, or they get their disability and shortly thereafter die. I mean, we're dealing with Vietnam veterans that are facing this. We're dealing with Iraq veterans that are facing this. We, even on this stage, on this radio station, are one of our founders, Michael Fortune, committed suicide on the 18th of July of this year. So we're not without it as well. But now we are talking about all races, because Michael Fortune was a white man. You know, I may be an African-American man, but Stephanie Racino, another hostess, is a white female. You know, and we have Andy Prado, who's Hispanic. So the thing is that we're all over the place as far as diversity, and that's what makes up America. But we owe our American veterans at least a fair living. This is why I have proposed in 2016, working with the city of Long Beach to make it happen, that we have a presidential debate for veterans and active duty issues. And we ask the veterans questions of what do you think would be something successful for veterans? Because the end result of it is that as we go to a presidential election, what would your question be? And see, as a veteran, as a veteran, I can ask several, but I want veterans to articulate over the next year what questions they would like to ask of both parties. I think the vice president and the president should answer this in September of 2016 before the voting starts, after the parties have their conventions, so that we can vet the final candidates of who's helping veterans.
Yes, in the presidential debates, the candidates in both the Republican and the Democratic Party, that needs to be an issue of concern and debate in the forums around the nation as we prepare to vote. There needs to be an emphasis on these veterans, and if they need something closer to home as a sort of a watch post, because right now I think our state is holding its breath as we look at Proposition 47, the penal system, the prison system. Who would have thought that America, the greatest nation in the history of our planet, the most powerful, the richest, and all, who would have thought that we could be so very short-sighted? But at this tick of the watch, America leads the world in prison construction and prison confinement. America leads the world, and California leads America. At this moment, there are 2.2 million people in prison in America. 50% of them black, 35% of them Hispanic or Latino. Now, look at that 50% black, 1 million brothers, sisters, a few sisters in lockdown, 90% of them there because of substance abuse, nonviolent crime. And you look at it and say that doesn't really seem to be fair. But then you see the background of it. Under the Reagan administration, the prison system changed from one of rehabilitation to one of punishment. We don't have rehab systems, and also the recidivism rate is that one out of three released from prison is back in prison within 3 years. Then another component was the privatizing of the prison system. So once it becomes private in a capitalist economy, then the owners of that prison going to keep it not only full, but overfilled, because they can make most money. It costs, as President Clinton pointed out in his book and in other statistical data, that it costs $25,000 to $40,000 a year to keep a man a year in prison, whereas for $15,000 a year, you can have a year in college. So here now, the prisons are privatized. They work not on rehabilitation, and they are terrifyingly expensive. And the Supreme Court has ruled that the prisons are overcrowded, thus unhealthy, thus they defy the constitutional law of the United States, which forbids inhumane treatment. So along comes Proposition 47. And I think it was a blessing. It took a list of what are violent crimes and pulled out of that master list six categories of what are not violent crimes but are now listed as misdemeanors. And in that list, substance abuse. Because just for a little finger of substance abuse, you could get 3 or 4 years sentencing. And then after you got 2 years, here comes the third strike law. You end up for life for something that is fine. The money that was saved from releasing prisoners, because we've got to release some 40,000 in our state within the time period, and the money that's saved from the releasing prisoners should be used for helping them to recover, to the family restoration, jobs, housing, mental illness treatment, substance abuse program treatment as needed. And we are watching to see if we are really going to do that. Those prisoners, instead of being treated like thugs and criminals, if you see they're human, and with the change of mentality and environment, you might get a change of personnel. It's certainly worth it to help them rehabilitate more than to put them back in prison. We'll get divisions on it because the conservatives are going to insist on that penal system being as it is. Right now we are building more prisons in our state, more costly and all, and expanding the penal system instead of shrinking it. So we have the veterans of the prison system who are overlooked, those who are veterans of fighting for rehabilitation are overlooked and unheard. So ball is in our court, and we will see within the next decade or two if we are going to be creative or destructive.
Well, this is where ADVIA America's Disabled Veterans in Action, ADVIA.media, is coming into the forefront, because what we try to do here is we talk about the issues that are germane to veterans and their families. Because some choose to have a lifestyle of service to their country and do serve out many years, we think that, the wage inequality between that of a general, which is if you're an O-10, which is the highest rank you can come in the military, is $30,000 a month, we can afford to be a little bit more generous with an E-1, who's only earning $1,561 a month.
Yes.
That person's time is worth much more than $1,561 a month. For most people, $18,000 in the real world, I don't care if you do have assisted housing and you do get subsidies in the BAQ and the BAS, your food and labor, and they even put clothes on your back. But $18,000 for $168 a week works down to $2.68 an hour. Even if you go up in rank to E6, E7, E8, and you get up into those ranks, you're still falling short of $7.52, which is the current minimum wage, and that's with time and grade. The thing is that we owe our veterans so much more. It's called an honor debt.
Yes.
And that honor debt is not something that I'm making up. This is something that George Washington himself stated. And it's due to every person. I was recently in the last 10 days, I recently learned that in the Militia Act of most states, that, and especially in Florida, I was looking at the state of Florida when I learned this, but when the militia started out in 1841 for Florida, it was every able-bodied white male between 18 and 35. After the Civil War, it became every able-bodied male between 18 and 45.
Yes.
Then, after many, many years, and it went through several revisions, a couple more revisions, but it did not really significantly change until 1968, when it was between 18 and 45 for every able-bodied person. But the promises in each successive militia act were for to provide for the food, the housing, and transportation of the militia. So I don't know anybody, and in order to join the militia, any able-bodied person would be anyone that was able to participate in the election of the chief executive officer for the state. So who would that be? Anyone that votes. That's what that essentially amounts to. So if you're voting, you're a part of the militia. So the thing is that if you're a part of the militia and they're not honoring their duty to do those that sacrifice so much and give up their time and labor sacrifice, this is what I'm talking about, because if we devalue a human being of the ability to support a family, then we're denying them human rights. And I think that when we do this to veterans, that's what happens, and that's why it has fallen upon the creation of ADVIA to kind of advocate for that, because it's important that we bring forth these ideals, because when you're in the military and you take that oath, you accept that contract. But I don't think very many people sit down and say, well, I've only got 168 hours in a week. And if I go into New York City and I want to drive a subway, they'll pay me $68 and change just to start. All I need is a high school diploma and pass the test. Okay, if I want to go to the Newark Fire Department. I have to be Newark, New Jersey Fire Department. I have to be 18 years old, pass the civil test. If I can pass the test, I can get hired at starting at close to $60,000 a year. So the thing is that we have to start to walk towards the military with an ASVAB. Now, the thing is that if we start with that ASVAB, we should be paying them a living wage. I don't think that that's so asking too much, because a lot of veterans are not only male, they're female veterans out here that have children. And sometimes these veterans are single parents. When they're out here looking for resources in the communities, there's none to be found. And that, to me, is a disgrace, because we're coming up to the Year of the Veteran, coming up in 2016. It's supposed to be the Year of the Veteran. And so we have to look at this, because when we have veterans that are called up to active duty for one reason or another, and they have to leave their children behind, those parental rights have to be protected, because there are judges out here that will seek to terminate the rights of parents who are in the military. So these are just a few of the things that I feel that we had to talk about in the media, because in the mainstream media, day in and day out, veterans stay excluded. We don't get 15 seconds. And even if you add up all the coverage that we get on Veterans Day, it's not enough to cover the rest of the days of the year. So we need to have a place that we can come and get news and information. And that's what we fancy ourselves to be here at ADVIA. And we're, you know, again, we're so honored to have you here and take a little of your time on this Veterans Day in 2015 to share with you a little of our mission, because, you know, you, in your body of work in the city of Los Angeles, have been a community leader and are a veteran. And so we're very honored to have you on the airwaves, because you're Air Force of the Korean War. And that is something that, you know, everyone that has come to our airwaves to speak, we always try to make sure that we cover the veterans. So we hope that you'll feel at home here, Pastor.
You have been extraordinarily kind to host this old fuddy duddy preacher. I thank God for you. I thank God for my 10 years in the Air Force. I thank God for the positive components that our nation reaches out to with its veterans, and anticipate that there will be greater research done into the problem of troubled veterans, so that we can find a way to help our brothers and our sisters who made a way to help us all. I had several bouts of danger while on flying duty for those 10 years in the Air Force, but I don't have a sense of feeling that anybody's obligated to me, but I sure feel obligated toward those veterans who gave their lives, who risked their lives, and who even today, when we are relatively not at war, are yet there on the brink of being sent and are willing to go. So thank you for the great work you're doing, and we remember you in our prayers, George Anderson.
Well, I thank you, Pastor. One of the last things I wanted to get your comment on, because we have a lot of veterans that have served and deal with military sexual trauma, and that is something that is so sensitive. The thing is that the young man who I was telling about that was in our own ranks, he was one of the first that I knew that came forward to advocate about that issue. The thing is that to me adds to the importance of what we're doing, not only from the standpoint of just issues of service, because there are many veterans out there We have a caller that calls in frequently. I haven't heard from her recently, named Dorothy. And Dorothy will call in from time to time, and she was abused.
Yes.
Sexually, mentally, and physically, all because she answered the call of our service. Now, she was an officer. This
yes.
is an officer that we're talking about. So the thing is that we, for whatever it is that we go in service for, we are used in the service of this nation. And in the process of being used in the service of this nation, I just want to say I think we deserve a lot more. And like I said, I just hope that my prayer, my fervent prayer by us doing this show is that by using the free press that we can advocate for greater help for our veterans beyond just Veterans Day. So, you know.
Yes, in the process of being used, we are sometimes misused, and a nation of conscience and conscientiousness as our nation can be, it is our obligation to see that those who are used are not abused or misused. And when they are, there are some prices to pay for those misusing. And if we are the ones misusing because we don't take proper procedures and methods of making up for the pain that they suffer, then we are cruising for a bruising, because we cannot continue in this manner.
Absolutely. Well, Pastor, I want to thank you for joining
us
tonight. It has been a full show, and we are honored to have your presence with us.
Thank you, my precious friend.
We will be back tomorrow, Thursday, with a full show beginning at 4 p.m., and we will bring you the latest and greatest that we have from Congress and from the four corners of the earth regarding veterans. As soon as we get it, we put it in the news. We want to thank everybody for helping us today. As it stands, we could not do without your support. If we were to say that we could do otherwise, it would not be so. As we close out today, I am honored to report that we reach over 250,000 people per week. 250,000 people. We have, when I look at the fact of the matter that we are looking at 29,000 people that follow us on Facebook, over 500 people on Twitter, just in the advocacy veteran community, I think that speaks volumes. And it's not from the standpoint that we're going anywhere, but we're going to continue to be around. And with the support of our past veterans like Reverend Murray and others, I am honored to be here to serve as one of the hosts to bring this program to you. Well, America, it's not our usual sign out, but we've come to the end of our broadcast. Pastor, if you'll stay with me through the closing, we've come to the end of our broadcast, and I want to thank you guys for listening in, and we'll be back at 2300 Zulu tomorrow, which is 6 p.m. Atlantic, 8 p.m. 2300 Zulu, 8 p.m. Atlantic, 7 Eastern, 6 Central, 5 Mountain, 4 Pacific, 3 o'clock Alaska, and 1 o'clock Hawaii, 9 a.m. Guam. We're heard on all corners of the earth. We want to thank all the veterans about the world for their duty to stay and every day, but have a safe day on this Veterans Day, and our prayers are with you. Hang out with me a moment, Pastor. Well, we're out of here, folks, until tomorrow.